Paddy Al-Masri joins me on the line. Paddy, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you. Thanks for that.
You have been causing a stir in the last couple of days with the lovely news that you've just opened a pharmacy in rural County Carlow, in Ballon, in fact. And it's particularly notable because you are one of the first people from Syria to have been formally resettled in Ireland. Tell us a little of your life story.
Exactly. I am the first first Syrian refugee here in Ireland. In 2014, they chose us to be from the first group who came to Ireland, that was like exactly on December 2014. We went to Mosny first in Drogheda, then we settled in Bortleash after that.
And what brought you to Carlow?
I worked in a few places before in Bortleash. Then I started like locoming around. I work at Loughran Bridge. That's like an area here near one of the County Carlow villages. So I was like checking the place always. I said like there is a great opportunity to open here. And that's what I did.
And you were already in business, you were already a pharmacist in your home city of Homs in 2011 when the uprising against Bashar al-Assad began in that year. You'd studied at the British College in Jordan. It's a long, long road in so many ways from Homs to Ballon.
It's long, long road. Let's say it's a dramatic was like the, you know what the refugees' story is, how that like started in 2011, and we tried like just to look in the future, don't look back. It was like hard journey, but here we are now. Like,
and how did you feel, Fadi, on Sunday night? You know, getting ready to open your own pharmacy in Ballon on Monday morning, given all that has happened to you over the last decade.
When I stand up, just like it was like a great moment for me on Sunday night when I was prepared the place there, and I said like, "Is that will happen again? Did I will back to this again? It will be my own pharmacy again. That's unbelievable. Look, it's a great opportunity to have your own job. Like it's a chance to have your own life again." That was like incredible moment when I opened on Monday morning my own shop after like, let's say, 11 years now.
And not only your own shop, but you're employing people in the local community. You are, because of your position as a pharmacist, trusted in the local community, an integral part of the local community.
I said like it's a... one of the things to be back for Ireland, like to be active in the community again, to do something for the community again, to be, we can't be back to Ireland, but look, we try to help to settle. We try, like, especially with the pandemic, like people were looking for work, and that, like, the opportunity for pharmacy, the demand for the pharmacy is increased during the pandemic. So I hired like three people from the area itself. The amount of the CVs I get it, like, when I start advertise the place was like I didn't expect it. So I said like I hope I will try to help those people, give a good service and give something back, you know.
And what's the reaction in Ballon been like, Fadi?
The welcoming I get it in the first day, and the flowers I get, all the cards, all the wishes was like unexpected. And the people was like very exciting that they are like have something in the village to help them, like no need to drive long now to get their prescription. They are not worried if they need like some emergency stuff or drive to Carlow or any other place like to have. So they are really happy.
It's been a huge month for you. I understand you welcome your first baby not so long ago.
Yes, actually, yesterday was like 1 month.
Oh,
exactly. So all came together, thanks God, in a good way. Like,
well, that is fantastic. Congratulations on the birth of your baby and absolutely continued success with your new pharmacy. That is Fadi Al-Masri. He's a pharmacist and owner of the Ballon Pharmacy in Ballon Village in Carlow. And as he said, he is the first person, the first refugee to be resettled in Ireland from Syria. Now, the Irish Times tells us that what it describes as serious legal concerns have been raised about the assisted dying bill. That bill is currently undergoing scrutiny by the Oireachtas Committee on Justice, which coincidentally is chaired by Kildare North Fianna Fáil TD James Lawless. But to discuss the bill, the Dying with Dignity Bill, I'm joined on the line, and indeed the attendant legal concerns, by the deputy who introduced it to the Dáil, People Before Profit TD Gino Kenny. Gino, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks, Ciara. Thank you.
I suppose, first of all, what the Irish Times is telling us is that it has seen a confidential legal opinion drafted by the Office of Parliamentary Legal Advisers. Now, a legal opinion is a legal opinion. It's not binding nor necessarily instructive.
No, it's not binding, and it's part of the process in relation to any piece of legislation. Now, obviously, an issue such as, you know, a voluntary assisted dying is a very, very complex issue. So it's, you know, obviously the Office of Parliamentary Legal Advisers have looked over it. They have kind of observed certain kind of legal observations with it and concerns. But it's up to the Justice Committee to take that all on board and then, you know, proceed with the scrutiny of the bill and the wider debate around voluntary assisted dying. And obviously, earlier on in the year, they had written submissions by members of the public and individuals about the substantial issue. So there's still a long way to go. Mm. And, you know, we've said from the outset that the legislation itself is far from a finished article as such, and we're open for amendments. So I think that kind of we were steadfast from the start on that.
So the Times is telling us that the opinion includes a part of the bill would be vulnerable to constitutional challenge, as there was an over-delegation of ministerial power, which case law found to be incompatible with the Constitution. It identifies ambiguities and serious drafting errors in several sections of the bill, including flaws that could render them vulnerable to challenge before the courts, as well as errors of a more technical nature throughout the bill. Do any of those have merit for you, Gino?
Well, I haven't seen the legal opinion document, and you know, there's obviously other bills, opposition bills, and government bills that could be open to legal challenge and constitutional challenge. So, no, this bill is nothing different from other kind of pieces of legislation that members of the Oireachtas have submitted. So, there's nothing new with that. Mm. The main point is, where do we go from here? You know, because, you know, the Dáil has to deal with this issue, because in October, a majority of TDs, 81 to 71, voted to proceed to the next stage of legislation. And that next stage was to go to the Justice Committee and to deal with the issue. Obviously, this is legal opinion, and I think it's welcome that there's observations of this nature.
Yeah.
But it's important now to proceed into, you know, the next step of, you know, of this. That's a legal opinion. There's also a political opinion and a civic opinion, a medical opinion, and kind of all. They're the kind of number of pillars that are kind of in the kind of the ongoing debate. But it's important now that we move on. Where other jurisdictions and countries around the world have legislated for voluntary assisted dying.
Because I think people hearing, you know, the headline that a legal concern has been raised about a proposed law on assisted dying, and it is an accurate headline, might draw different conclusions other than the provision of legal opinion by this particular parliamentary legal advisor's office is a natural part of the drafting of any new bill.
Yeah, it's a natural kind of, I suppose, evolution of any piece of legislation. And opposition bills obviously get the full rigour of the Office of Parliamentary Legal Advisers and other kind of bodies as well. It's not just this body that has made observations in relation to the Irish Human Rights and Equality Commission. Obviously looked at the bill and they said there is kind of concerns in relation to it, but they didn't say, look, it's completely flawed and we have to start anew. They didn't say that. So there is, and we take all them observations kind of to account, and kind of, you know, we're willing when it gets to amendment stage, to kind of, because the bill could look completely different. I mean, completely different from what it is now. So,
you wouldn't mind that, Gino, as long as the substantive matter contained in the bill is legislated for.
Exactly. And if the government want to produce a piece of legislation on the issue rather than their bill, we're open to that. But as long as the issue gets legislated for, or there's a really meaningful debate around it, and you know, obviously, I would like to see, and I think a lot of people in this country would like to see the law changed.
Mm.
So that could happen. That could happen. There's a lot of twists and turns in relation to this kind of piece of legislation and the issue over the next 18 months. But the next stage of that process is that the Justice Committee, I think, is going to meet in private on the 13th of July. They'll make a recommendation where we go with this issue, and hopefully that it will make recommendations with legal advice to the scrutiny of the bill and the kind of the substantial issue from all the stakeholders, and I mean every stakeholder that have made a submission, the written submissions around this substantial issue. And I think that would be productive.
Yeah.
I know the legal opinion mentioned something about the Citizens Assembly and then again principle against that. And they also mentioned, setting up a special Oireachtas committee. But, back in October, the government put an amendment to our bill to say that a committee should be set up, but that was defeated. So it's really important, the government listen to the 81 TDs that, voted against their amendment. That 81 TDs, including, I should say, half the cabinet of this country actually voted to say, look, this bill should go to the next stage, as in pre-legislative scrutiny. That doesn't mean they want to see it legislated for. We'll see what happens over that particular time. But, there's a groundswell in this country, and like other countries, that want to see change and a meaningful debate. And when I say meaningful debate, something that is not a talking shop, but something that kind of at the end of that process, what I would like to see, and I think a lot of people to see, is to see the change in the law around voluntary assisted dying.
So the next key date in terms of this bill, as you've noted, Gino, the 13th of July, and after that we'll have a clearer picture of the path forward with this piece of legislation.
I think so, Ciarán. Basically, the Justice Committee, which are dealing with this issue, they will give a recommendation of what the committee does next. As I said earlier on the year, they invited the public for written submissions, and I think there's over 1,000 written submissions in relation to the issue, from groups, individuals, and from the full spectrum of the debate. Those that are opposed, those that are for, those that have it somewhere in the middle.
Mm.
So there's that all going on, which is very, very good. And that has to be taken into account. But, the most important thing for us is that this can't be unduly delayed. Because, this has been going on for a good of about 10 years, and obviously in October of last year, there was a substantial step forward in relation to the vote. The bill is not perfect by any means. We're open to amendments. It's blank canvas in some ways. A bill can be very, very radically changed through the process of amendments, and that we're open to that. But as long as the substantial issue is dealt with, and that substantial issue that voluntary assisted dying is legalised in Ireland.
Gino Kenny, People Before Profit TD, and indeed the person who introduced the Dying with Dignity Bill into the Dáil. Thank you indeed for joining us. Coming up after the break, we'll have an update on operations at Nice General in the wake of the cyber attack, and we'll hear of a study which shows that the perceived fear of losing children is a significant barrier to women accessing addiction treatment. The HSE has made very significant progress in coming back from the devastating effects of the cyber attack upon it of just last month. However, it continues to impact services. Kildare Focus producer Ciarán Noble was joined by Alice Kinsella, General Manager at Nice General Hospital, for the latest on the situation there.
Good afternoon, Ciarán. So I'd like to update our listeners at the moment. The cyber attack has caused severe disruption in recent weeks, and our staff, with the support of the HSE ICT colleagues, are continuing to work on restoring systems. Good progress has been made in restoring some of our systems, but services throughout the hospital are continuing to see significant impact and disruptions. We do have manual workarounds in many departments, and I would just like to reiterate that essential services are continuing. The emergency department is seeing high attendances at the moment for this time of the year. I would like to ask your patients to consider their care options, either via their GP or out of hours, before presenting to the emergency department. But the emergency department is open 24 hours a day, and patients who require urgent care will be prioritised.
For those who need to reschedule appointments, what is the protocol there?
So for any patients whose appointment was cancelled, the hospital will be contacting them directly to reschedule appointments over the next number of weeks. And so patients should attend the hospital if they have not been notified not to attend. They will be contacted directly by the hospital if their appointment is not proceeding.
Obviously.
And then we will be rescheduling any patients who had their appointments cancelled due to the cyber attack.
Obviously, no blame on the hospital. We know this was a cyber attack. But wait times for the rescheduling of appointments, Alice, what are people looking at?
Well, we have started. So some people have had their appointments already rescheduled. And over the next couple of weeks, we'll hope to have all the appointments rescheduled.
Now, routine outpatient radiology does remain cancelled. Have you any idea when this will be back up and running?
No, again, as soon as we're in a position to reschedule appointments, we'll cancel patients directly. But our radiology department is still not functioning at full capacity.
Now, you did note that your emergency department is quite busy as of late. Is that to do with COVID-related illnesses?
Well, I suppose we are seeing high presentations to the emergency department. And again, you know, that patients are presenting with, you know, a range of conditions. It's not just COVID-related. At the moment, we have no COVID-positive patients in the hospital. Sorry, Ciara, just before I go, I would just like to thank the public for their continuous patience, and we greatly appreciate their continued support. And I would also like to thank the staff. They have been working continuously over the last number of weeks just for their continued commitment and dedication in order to get services restored as quick as possible. We do have a contact number if the public would like to contact with any queries, and that is 045 849910, and lines are open Monday to Friday 8:30 to 5 p.m. and the HSE website is also updated on a regular basis with any changes to our services or disruptions, and people can contact the HSE website at www.hse.ie.
Alice Kinsella, General Manager at Nice General Hospital. Thank you.
Thanks, Ciara.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Alice.
And that was Kildare Focus producer Ciara Noble. Now, a major study on supporting women to access appropriate treatment called SWAT has found that the perceived fear of losing children is a significant barrier to women accessing addiction treatment. I'm joined now on the line by Dr. Johanna Ivers. She's Assistant Professor in Addiction at the School of Medicine at Trinity College Dublin. Johanna, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks for having me.
This is a really, really important study, because I think it's been anecdotally known for some time that, women access addiction treatment on a far less frequent basis than men do. And it might be one of the only areas of healthcare that I can readily think of where it is the case that women's engagement with it is lesser than men's.
Absolutely. And we had the launch yesterday, and we tried to highlight that. You're absolutely spot on. In terms of like public health, women tend to be quicker to the GP, quicker to screening programs. But yeah, when it comes to addiction treatment, they tend to show up less. And to give you a perspective, we know that women count for 1 in 3 people with severe addiction issues, but they only account for 1 in 5 presentations at treatment across Europe.
That is a really significant disparity.
Absolutely.
And I would imagine that, that really much with any health matter, but particularly with addiction matters, the disparity itself is very, very complex. But one of your key findings, I think for a lot of people, would make sense as being a key factor in that disparity, and that is a woman's fear of losing her children should she access addiction treatment.
Absolutely, because the perception was that, and there was truth to this in terms of the service providers, not just the women, but also the service providers said that when a woman presents for treatment, you know, it kickstarts a report to TUSLA, and that's, you know, spot on, because children have to be looked after, but the woman's needs become secondary then. And people see the woman as, you know, engaging in risky behaviour and therefore exposing the child to some level of risk. So, yeah, it was a real perceived threat for the women, you know.
And is that also the case if a father living in the family home presents for treatment, Johanna, that a report is issued to TUSLA?
No, my understanding is that is not the case, that the women... and again, because of the women that we spoke to, of the 22 women, 16 of them were parents. So, and the sole responsibility kind of lay with them in terms of reporting matters and childcare.
Well, if that was widely known in a community that was afflicted by drug addiction, that if you seek treatment, a report is automatically going to go to TUSLA if you're a woman, but not necessarily if you're a man. Why would you go if that would risk your children being removed from you?
Exactly. Well, I suppose the message that the services would say is that a report doesn't actually mean that the child will be taken away, which is what the woman was starting from. So in order to kind of break down those barriers and get women to engage, there's a huge information piece that needs to be shared. There's strategic engagement that has to happen between TUSLA and the addiction services to reassure women that actually this is a supportive kind of process, and it doesn't mean that reporting equals the removal of the child.
But I think everybody could understand that if you're in addiction and you hear that a report is going to be made to TUSLA, that would be your primal fear.
Absolutely, and the judgment that goes with that then as well, you know, in terms of your immediate community and people knowing that then.
And
absolutely.
I would imagine that judgment and the fear of the stigma and the fact of the stigmatisation of women seeking treatment for addiction, Johanna, is another huge barrier to them being able to take that step in the first place.
Absolutely. Women felt that, you know, the whole point of being a woman in society, you have to be a particular way, and being a woman who uses drugs and then being a woman who uses drugs and a parent, then that kind of did not fit with that perception, and that there would be a lot of judgment, and as you say, why would you expose yourself to that?
Did you, in the report, Johanna, look at some of the life histories of the women who took part in the study to kind of give an indication as to how they came to this position?
Absolutely, Ciara. And it's, you know, not surprisingly, of the 22 women, 20 spoke explicitly about, you know, traumatic life events. And they were quite significant in terms of, you know, huge amount of bereavement of children, bereavement of parents early in their life, bereavement of partners. Where there was bereavement, it tended to be a traumatic death and a premature death. And then lots of abuse, domestic violence, very little access to, you know, education and employment opportunities that the rest of us might enjoy, you know.
And of the women that were able and that chose to access addiction treatment, either for drugs or alcohol, Johanna, within the remit of the study, how did that pan out for them?
Yeah, I mean, once they were there, and again, we know this from there was a presentation from Professor David Best, who's an international leader in recovery. Again, a kind of interesting statistic is that women are slow to show up to treatment or show up at a much lesser rate. But once we get them in the door, reassure them, they tend to have a more stable recovery. than males. So that's quite an interesting thing. It is about getting them to show up, and then once we engage them in the way, and again, it's simple stuff. Start small and kind of build on trust and respect. And once you have a woman that has been traumatized, you know, they're the kind of small steps we need to take. But when we do invest at that level, we see that it bears a lot of fruit.
So what needs to happen now, Johanna?
I think a couple of things need to happen. I think we need to be, you know, we need to start to respond to women's needs differently to how we are at the moment. The, you know, a lot of the service users and providers talked about the services being, you know, opioid-centric, male-centric, and that the age appropriateness wasn't always there in terms of then substance use response, that we kind of need to adapt the services for that. But really, we need to take a gender based approach as well, because women's needs are different to men's needs, and we need to get that on the agenda. But in terms of the headline, as you say, in terms of getting women, there is a huge piece, but it, you know, a fixable piece that needs to happen between addiction services and TUSLA.
Well, Dr. Johanna Ivers, Assistant Professor in Addiction at the School of Medicine at Trinity College Dublin, thank you indeed for joining us. Coming up after the break, we'll be discussing why certain celebrities receive abuse on certain social media platforms. Dependent upon your perspective, Twitter is a very useful way of communicating with the world, or a cesspool. And certain celebrities, certain people of note get a disproportionate level of abuse. And I'm joined on the line now by Christopher Hand. He's a lecturer in psychology at Glasgow Caledonian University, and he has been researching in this matter. Christopher, you're very welcome to the programme.
Good afternoon, how are you?
I'm not too bad at all. Sometimes the level of abuse, any particular notable person, and it doesn't have to be a celebrity, it could be a politician, a musician, a sports star, somebody of note, that sometimes the level of abuse that is meted out at them is breathtaking.
Absolutely. It's frightening how rapidly an individual's actions, whether it be on the sports field or in their personal life or in Parliament, get seized upon. And you're absolutely right. I mean, a lot of the abuse that people face is absolutely abhorrent.
And I mean, this abuse can take many forms and tone. It can be dependent on the person against at whom it is inflicted. It can be racist. It can be homophobic. It can be a downright verbal violence. But the old trope that people were felt more free on, let's say, platforms such as Twitter, etc., to vent their spleen, to express their bile at others, because it can be anonymous if you want, only goes so far in explaining the linguistic structure of how an awful lot of people communicate on Twitter.
I think that's a very important point, is that you know, social media is the vehicle for behaviours that have existed for you know, since time immemorial. I think where the problem arises is that it's the connectivity. So politicians is an interesting one. You know, politicians would have had people abusing them at their constituency offices or at hustings or in the street, or even sending them correspondence or something. But, you know, that would tend to be quite local. But now, you know, people from all over the world, and you're absolutely right, you know, the key things that seem to come up would be, you know, the kind of gender-based harassment or racially motivated or religiously motivated. And it's deeply unpleasant. But, I mean, I think you're right, the anonymity can only go so far. And at what point, you know, you have to remove people's right to anonymity is something that has to be looked at, and exactly how these platforms put into place checks and balances so that people are identifiable and therefore their actions maybe have more consequences is something that needs to be looked at.
To investigate why Twitter is Twitter, but also why victim blaming occurs when celebrities or people of note in any field of endeavour are subjected to abuse. You set up two separate studies. Sketch those out for us, Christopher, if you could.
So in our research, we were really interested in the the behaviour of the victim, so how that relates to perceptions of blame and perceptions of severity, how the behaviours of other people online relate to it, and also the individual characteristics of the person who's observing it. So we created a bunch of stimuli that were based on real tweets. So the tweet itself can either be something that's quite positive, friendly and outgoing and polite, or it could be something that was much more negative, hostile. Then we had responses that were the same, you know, they were either positive or negative. And we asked people to judge, you know, who is responsible for any problematic content. You know, is it the original person, the victim? Is it the people that have sent the abuse? And also we tried to tap into the features of the observer themselves. So, you know, were they a sort of slightly psychotic person? Were they sadistic? Were they Machiavellian? Did they get a kick out of this kind of manipulation of other people? And what we saw is that people who behave negatively online, people who post negative things to begin with, don't get any sympathy with the abused. You know, they are seen to have sort of, you know, hung themselves on their own rope. And what we see is that celebrities are treated differently than members of the public.
That little point, Christopher, there, people who post negative things get little or no sympathy. I wonder how much of that is pertaining to the cult of positivity, in that if I just say I don't like jam, oh, you're against all jam, how dare you, and people rear up and would attack you, where that's just an opinion about jam.
I think that's a really excellent example, because the stimuli in our study were those kind of words. Like, you know, we weren't going for the sensational and the provocative. We were going for things where, exactly as you said, just an expression of a kind of daily, everyday expression of kind of interest or opinion. And yet, we still see polarised and deeply emotional responses. I think it's that calling.
Christopher, if you could just move around a small bit, your line is dropping out there. That's much better. Sorry, you were saying.
Sorry about that. So yeah, you know, even expressing opinions about the most mundane of things can draw responses from people who have deeply polarized or extreme opinions, and that is one of the, you know, one of the sort of double-edged swords of the online presence, is that it gives people that platform to share their opinions, but at the same time, it simultaneously exposes them to people with opposite but potentially extremist viewpoints, whether it's jam or marmalade or peanut butter.
Or the great...
You're going to attract the nut allergy again.
Or somebody who thinks that smooth peanut butter should be raised from the face of the world.
I'm not going to touch that with a 20-foot pole.
No, nor I. We're going to leave that one there. It's interesting, though, that people find that if you tweet a view, a notable person or otherwise, with which they don't agree and are therefore abused because of it, that it is your own fault, rather than standing and looking objectively going, is that opinion, is that statement in any way worthy of this tsunami-like response?
That's in a nutshell. And one of the things that we're starting to look at is what drives, you know, the perception of whether it's a negative or a positive post. And again, a lot of it is, you know, is it shared by someone who's a member of your in-group or out-group? You know, so if I identify with the original poster, whether that's based on nationality or ethnicity or religiosity or whatever, I'm probably more likely to align with them at, you know, a subconscious level, so I'm going to be more sympathetic to them if they're abused. But at the same time, if something is posted by someone from my out-group, I might be more likely to judge something that's actually fairly mundane and fairly neutral, but I might see that through a lens of negativity. So, it's, you know, it might look like a reaction to the post, but in fact, at a subconscious level, it might be because it's posted by a person who falls, you know, under a different political alignment or a religious group or national identity. So, you know, there is that really tantalising kind of interplay between who is doing the posting and what they're actually posting about.
Well, Christopher Hand, lecturer in psychology at Glasgow Caledonian University, thank you indeed for joining us.